Shall we read the first paragraph? When spirituality disengages itself in the consciousness and puts on its distinctive character, it is only at first a small kernel, a growing tendency, an exceptional light of experience amidst the great mass of normal, unenlightened human mind, vitality, physicality, which forms the outer self and engrosses our natural preoccupation. There are tentative beginnings and a slow evolution and hesitating emergence. An earlier first preliminary form of it creates a certain kind of religiosity which is not the pure spiritual temperament, but is of the nature of mind or life, seeking or finding in itself a spiritual support or factor. In this stage, man is mostly preoccupied with the utilization of such contacts as he can get or construct with what is beyond him to help or serve his mental ideas or moral ideas or his vital and physical interests. The true turn to some spiritual change has not come. The first true formations take the shape of a spiritualization of our natural activities, a permeating influence on them or a direction. There is a preparatory influence or influx in some part or tendency of the mind or life. A spiritualized turn of thought with upling illuminations, or a spiritualized turn of the emotional or the aesthetic being. A spiritual ethical formation in the character, a spiritualized urge in some life action or other dynamic vital movement of the nature. An awareness comes perhaps of an inner light, of a guidance or a communion, of a greater control than the mind and will to which something in us obeys. But all is not yet recast in the mold of that experience. But when these intuitions and illuminations grow in insistence and canalize themselves, make a strong inner formation and claim to govern the whole life and take over the nature, then there begins the spiritual formation of the being. There emerges the saint, the devotee, the spiritual sage, the seer, the prophet, the servant of God, the soldier of the spirit. All these take their stand on one part of the natural being, lifted up by a spiritual light, power or ecstasy. The sage and seer live in the spiritual mind. Their thought or their vision is governed and molded by an inner or greater divine light of knowledge. The devotee lives in the spiritual aspiration of the heart, its self-offering and its seeking. The saint is moved by the awakened psychic being in the inner heart, grown powerful to govern the emotional and vital being. The others stand in the vital kinetic nature driven by a higher spiritual energy and turned by it towards an inspired action, a God-given work or mission, the service of some divine power, idea or ideal. The last or highest emergence is the liberated man who has realized the self and spirit within him, entered into the cosmic consciousness, passed into union with the eternal, and so far as he still accepts life and action, acts by the life and energy of the power within him, working through his human instruments of nature. The largest formulation of this spiritual change in achievement is a total liberation of soul, mind, heart and action, a casting of them all into the sense of the cosmic self and the divine reality. The spiritual evolution of the individual has then found its way and thrown up its range of Himalayan eminences and its peaks of the highest nature. Beyond this height and largeness, there opens only the supramental ascent or the incommunicable transcendence.
What is interesting here is how Sri Aurobindo builds the bridge, as it were, between what he's talked of before and what he's calling the emergence of the spiritual man, or spirituality disengaging itself in the consciousness and putting on its distinctive character. So as he has spoken earlier, it is through the forms of things such as religion, occultism, and spiritual philosophy that there grows into humanity certain types that are marked by certain kinds of character. Okay, so a change of character takes place in which one finds the priest or the mage, as he's talking about. The mage is really is like a priest. The idea is the magus. The word magician comes from it. And the magi of the Christian baptism, original baptism of Christ, comes from it. And the idea points to or indicates a certain kind of occult priesthood as of the Zoroastrian priests, who were in some ways very similar to the Vedic priests because they form part of the same layer of culture, of spiritual culture. But that form, the form of the priest or the mage, is related more to the religious life in terms of knowing how to do the rituals right. Okay. Similarly, he talked about the man of piety, the just man. The man of piety or the just man becomes essentially an ethical being, the light of the rightness of things, is something that grows into the character. And then, of course, he also talked about the man of wisdom. And man of wisdom, in some sense, goes higher and is related to spiritual philosophy, somebody whose mind aspires. In the Gita, this is what Sri Krishna refers to as the jigyasu. So now these are all approaches to the divine, which remain in the domain of the human. But the bridge that he shows in this paragraph we have just covered relates, as it were, to each of them and also to some others, and shows that the nature parts, the parts of the nature, the physical, vital, and mental being, or specific aspects of these beings, for example, the life of the will, or the life of the emotional being, the life of the aesthetic being, the life of the ethical being, each of these can become doors through which something much greater than a formal change of character can take place. Some much greater content of spirit stuff can be infused into any of these, areas or doors of human existence. So that's why he brings up, it's a very interesting passage because he makes these beautiful fine distinctions between what to us otherwise would have just remained the domain of spiritual people. These are all considered spiritual beings. And, people hardly make the distinction between, for example, the sage, the prophet, the man of wisdom, the seer, etc., or, as he's saying, the servant of God or the soldier of the spirit. But here he is distinguishing them in terms of where it is that the spiritual impulse, the spiritual power is active in the nature. So in the case of the sage and seer, as he says, they are living in the spiritual mind. In other words, it's what was the jigyasu in the human sense has entered into a transpersonal domain of divine mind. That is, in the case of the sage and seer, it is the seeker or the knower of greater earthly wisdom has been lifted through the afflatus of the spirit into a closer contact with divine knowledge, with the higher planes of the mind, the cosmic planes of the mind. Similarly, he's talking over here of the nation is governed by a greater divine light of knowledge, by the devotee who lives in the spiritual aspiration of the heart. In the case of the devotee, there has been sometimes a big opening of the emotional being, and through that there is a certain contact with the occult reality of the divine. See, it's self-offering and seeking. Again, he's talking about the saint, and each of these distinctions is a very fine one, because the saint, each of them gives us access to the divine. That's why these are all aspects of the spiritual life, but they are not the integral spirituality, nor are they in a real sense the fullness of spirituality. The saint is moved by the awakened psychic being in the inner heart, grown powerful to govern the emotional and vital being. So the emotional and vital being, which are so difficult to control, are under the control of the psychic in the case of the saint. So there is a complete cessation, as it were, of all the egoistic drives of the vital, and a turning of these into something mild and in some sense holy. Then finally he's talking about an opening up of the vital to the spiritual afflatus. And there he's relating it to those two categories, the servant of God and the soldier of the spirit. These are the others he's talking about. The others stand in the vital kinetic nature driven by the higher spiritual energy and turned by it towards an inspired action. So these are men of action, the doers, a God-given work or mission, the service of some divine power, idea, or ideal. So in any of these cases, these are particular examples of spiritual vibhutis. They are more than human vibhutis. There may be human vibhutis, and that same human vibhuti with a greater afflatus of spiritual working in the nature instruments becomes a spiritual vibhuti. Yet none of these may be the full-fledged spiritual man, you see. And that's why he's saying that there has to be something even beyond that. And that's what he's talking about. The last or highest emergence is the liberated man who has realized the self and spirit within him, entered into the cosmic consciousness, passed into union with the eternal, and so far as he still accepts life and action, acts by the light and energy of the power within him, working through his human instruments of nature. So, in a way, the definition of the spiritual man, as Sri Aurobindo is giving it over here, is union with the spirit. It is to arrive at this kind of emergence into liberation, into freedom of the spirit. It's entry into a oneness with the one being there is, with Brahman. And it's utilization of the cosmic consciousness to, you know, sort of work through the nature and to express itself through the instrumentality. The largest formulation of the spiritual change and achievement is the total liberation of soul, mind, heart, and action. In this expression, even the nature part, so these are the two, and I draw your attention to the Sapta Chatushtaya and what we would like to consider next. There are two aspects to liberation or mukti. One is the liberation of the spirit, and the other is the liberation of the nature. Both must be achieved. One without the other does not give us grasp, or does not give us the ability to enjoy the life in the divine way. It doesn't give us the grasp of divine manifestation. So here he's talking about first the liberation of the spirit, and then through that, the liberation of soul, mind, heart, and action, a casting of them all into the sense of the cosmic self and the divine reality. So this fulfillment is really this up until this point, if this is achieved, the liberation of this of the spirit, the liberation of the nature, and the action of the cosmic consciousness through the liberated nature completely, if that is completed, then we have completed two stages of the triple transformation. It is as if the overmental realization is complete. That in itself gives us a tremendous, achievement or realization. And in some places, it is this that Sri Aurobindo calls the divine consciousness. In some places, of course, it's the supramental, transformed being that he calls the divine consciousness. But here, this is the sense in which the Gita holds its highest realization, and Sri Aurobindo has a footnote. This is the essence of the spiritual ideal and realization held before us by the Gita. And so beyond this, as he points out, the spiritual evolution of the individual has then found its way and thrown up its range of Himalayan eminences, and it speaks of highest nature. Beyond this height and largeness, there opens only the supramental ascent or the incommunicable transcendence. So this is the scope of the emergence of the spiritual man. Ultimately, at least, there has to be the thirst to liberate the spirit completely and bring it into union with the divine and with the cosmic consciousness. And secondly, to liberate the nature and to make it an instrument for the action of the cosmic consciousness. That is the spiritual man, one may say. Beyond that, there are infinite ranges that still exist, but the first of these would be the supramental manifestation, supramental realization.
Devashishna, would you say there is any kind of chronological ordering to these states? It seems to me that it's more that in any nature, though a particular part of the nature being ready for a transformation results in each of these states that he describes. Would you say that there is like any kind of ordering to it?
Like ordering between these kinds of beings that he has mentioned, like the saints, the seer, prophet, and etc.
Exactly.
Not really any ordering, but the ordering is really between what he has previous, the range of beings that he has previously discussed, like for example the priest and mage, the just man, the higher man, and things like that. And over here, the next range, which is that of, the seer and prophet and man of wisdom or the man of, the devotee and the what he's calling over here, the man of work and of war. So between the first set and the second set, there is a ordering or a hierarchy. And that hierarchy may not be something that we perceive, commonly, but it may actually be that there is a hierarchy of that sort in all our lives, experienced from life to life. Rebirth may bring, the operation of the Swadharma in terms of a certain degree of manifestation, of fulfillment, in some of the nature instruments. And then once that is achieved to some degree, a higher stage of the achievement of fulfillment would lead to a greater afflatus of spiritual expression in that same nature instrument. So there is an ordering there. But I think between these various things that he has mentioned, it is really a matter of swabhava and swadharma.
So that would be a question of previous development and your and the aspiration. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Debashista.
Debashista?
Yeah.
We have in the synthesis of yoga or Sri Aurobindo synthesis, there are these three traditional and one yoga of self-perfection. So, is there a prioritization there, or for that too, the kind of yoga that will suit a person depends on his swabhava and swadharma?
Yeah, the same. I'd say the same thing as over here. There is no prioritization there. It is again exactly that same thing. Whatever suits the swabhava and
But that is just as a starting point, and
swadharma.
then
As a starting point,
yes,
yeah.
and the aim is to do them all and synthesize them.
Correct. So actually, what is marvelous about the yoga, the synthesis of yoga, is that each one of those is the integral yoga. Even if you go through his yoga, but the path looks totally different. I mean, if you go through particularly things like his chapters on the yoga of knowledge, it is the seeking for the self, the seeking for the liberation, the entry into a kind of a reality that nothing can touch, the descent of knowledge, all these things take predominance. But ultimately, it comes around to achieving the whole of the integral yoga. So it is really very marvelous the way Sri Aurobindo presents each of these yogas. You see what a tremendous, mastery he had over the integral field of yoga.
Yeah, but still, when we talk about people who are driven by the heart and those who are driven by the mind, do we sometimes prioritize the mind over the heart, because we say that the mind is what human beings have achieved from distinct from the other creatures, so we have to prioritize it?
Well, there is a certain amount of kind of, sort of dichotomy. Not dichotomy, I'd say there are places in Sri Aurobindo, both in the synthesis as well as in other places, where he is talking about the mind as the starting point, you see, of the race, not of the individual, but mind you. He's saying that the human race is characterized by the development of mind. That is what the human being has, sort of as a mark of its humanity, and also as a mark of the history of humanity. So there is a certain kind of general, priority given in terms of the race. So the race, as far as the race is concerned, the race is dominated by the mind. And what one can see is that there is a social reality to this. The modern age is really a mental age. I mean, people may be very less developed in their minds. That's another matter. But what is structuring the age is the power of mental ideology. So from that point of view, a general human solution has to come in the realm of mind. The belief of man, the faith of man as a species, would rest on a wide opening taking place in the mental life of common humanity. But that does not mean that an individual is necessarily going to have to follow the way of the mind, or that that is superior to any other way. I don't think Sri Aurobindo is saying that anywhere.
Yeah, but when you say humanity and you say individual, that's a big gap. So what can we say about small communities?
When you term small community, see, community may be marked by sort of commonality of seeking, you see. So if a community defines itself, let's say that this is going to be a community of bhaktas, right, then there can be such a community. I mean, as far as communities go, it depends on the scope or ambit of the community. How is it defining itself? If it is just a community in the sense that villages are communities, right, there is no intention that is defining them, then there is no priority to anything. Everything is equal over there.
No, let's say a community like an ashram, or
Yeah.
they follow a certain let's say Sri Aurobindo, and Sri Aurobindo is vast, so such a community, can it have a prioritization?
No, it can't. A Sri Aurobindo ashram should not have any prioritization of this kind. What can happen is the fossilization of a form which passes off as the correct form, the one form to be followed. That can happen due to the need to order large numbers of people. So that, I mean, there is a common life that develops. But that common life can have only an external, sort of reality. As far as the inner life goes, at least as far as Sri Aurobindo yoga is concerned, there has to be complete openness in terms of the yogas that people can follow.
Mm-hmm. And that should be true for, let's say, Sri Ramakrishna community or Sai Baba community.
Well, it depends on the goal, you see. Now, that's why I said, like, let's say when you're talking about Sri Ramakrishna community and Sai Baba, well, Sri Ramakrishna, it depends on who is giving it a certain form, because the goal of the Sri Ramakrishna community is not so distinct. That's why there was a division right in the beginning when Vivekananda wanted to give it a certain ashram. Firstly, there were no sannyasis there. When Vivekananda created a form for it, he created an Advaita Vedantic form for it. In other words, it became the goal of the members of Ramakrishna Math to attain to, to moksha. So, in a way, if you look at Sri Ramakrishna and you look at the Ramakrishna ashrams, there is a fossilization that has taken place from one to the other. But while Vivekananda was forming the ashrams, a number of people broke away and they refused to be part of it for this very reason.
The reason that it's getting fossilized.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But, say, that's why I said, depending on the scope of the ashram and the scope of the yoga, people voluntarily accept certain things. A Vaishnava yoga, like let's say the Gaudiya mission, it follows a Vaishnava yoga. So it's almost like saying we are a community of bhaktas, right? So now if somebody from Advaita Vedanta leaning comes into a Gaudiya mission, sooner or later they will say that you are going somewhere quite different from where we are going. And they're justified in saying that, because it is an intentional community with a certain fixed focus of goal.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Sure.
Sitaram, would you like to read? Anybody else? Keka? Okay, so maybe Lopa, you can read.
What's the this then? This then has been up till now the course of nature's evolution of the spiritual man in the human mental being. And it may be questioned, what is the exact sum of this achievement and its actual significance? In the recent reaction towards the life of the mind in matter, this great direction and this rare change have been stigmatized as no true evolution of consciousness, but rather a sublimated crudity of ignorance deviating from the true human evolution, which should be solely an evolution of life power.
Keka needs to mute, I think. Go.
Let me read the sentence again. in the recent reaction to a. Okay, it's echoing very badly. In the recent reaction towards the life of the mind in matter, this great direction and this rare change have been stigmatized as no true evolution of consciousness, but rather a sublimated crudity of ignorance deviating from the true human evolution, which should be solely an evolution of life, the practical physical mind, the reason governing thought and conduct, and the discovering and organizing intelligence. In this epoch, religion was pushed aside as an out-of-date superstition and spiritual realization and experience discredited as a shadowy mysticism. The mystic in this view is the man who turns aside into the unreal, into occult regions of a self-constructed land of chimeras and loses his way there. This judgment proceeds from a view of things which is itself bound to pass into discredit, because it depends ultimately on the false perception of the material as alone real and the outward life as alone importance. But apart from this extreme materialistic view of things, it can be and is still held by the intellect and the physical mind eager for human life fulfillment. And that is the prevalent mentality, the dominant modern trend, that the spiritual tendency in humanity has come to very little. It has not solved the problem of life, nor any of the problems with which humanity is at grips. The mystic either detaches himself from life as the otherworldly ascetic or the aloof visionary, and therefore cannot help life, or else he brings no better solution or result than the practical man or the man of intellect and reason. By his intervention, he rather disturbs the human values, distorts them with his alien and unverifiable light, obscure to the human understanding, and confuses the plain, practical, and vital issues life puts before us.
In a way, this is a short paragraph in which Sri Aurobindo is presenting the case of modern man against recognizing the value or need for a spiritual evolution. Actually, it's a very important paragraph because the question is what stands in the way? Because in today's world, we can see that many thinkers have made the point that mind has come to the end of its rope. As I said earlier, H.G. Wells has written a brief history of the world in which his last chapter was called Mind at the End of its Tether. H.G. Wells himself was one of the, you may say, rationalists of that age, along with people like Bertrand Russell, etc. And so the recognition of the fact that mind does not offer solutions that can really help mankind to cross, over the crises that have been created in modern times is there at some level or the other. But it is difficult to accept it. It's much better to continue, sort of going around in circles, looking for a solution in a cage with no outlet, rather than, accept the fact that the solution is to open the door of the cage and go out. So he's pointing, and this is this chapter points to why it is such an intractable problem of modern times. Why it is, as when Kirit Joshi was holding those few, discourses that he had with some of us, why it is that he was saying that mental life of modern man is obstinately opposed to the opening of the gates of the spiritual life. Partly it is a problem of history. The trajectory, and we discussed this to some extent, and more and more modern or contemporary thinkers are becoming aware of this, discussing it, that the modern age starts with this kind of faith in reason, the faith in the ability to organize a perfect world through the power of reason. And there's about 500 years or 600 years of European history behind that kind of urge. And to either, whether we look at it as the world market or capitalism and the liberal nation state, or whether we look at it as communism, which is a more refined version in a sense of the same, because it's even more organized in its idea of bringing about a so-called perfect world by the power of reason, we find that it is very difficult after 500 years. There is a momentum built up. It's the momentum of motion. See? The momentum of motion of an enormous machine, which, very difficult to put the brakes on that. So that is one of the problems. And he shows two sides of that problem. One is the more extreme version of that problem, where the spiritual life is, in a sense, completely, rejected on the basis of being illusory, a shadowy mysticism, as he says. It is illusory. It has no reality at all. Okay. So, but Sri Aurobindo points out that that particular argument can hold for only so long, because as the psychological life of man becomes more, powerful, in this insistence on the external and practical life, on the organization of life by mind, is going to some extent become no longer a convincing argument. So that is one problem. But there is a less or more moderate aspect to the same problem, which is, even if we don't reject it on the grounds of illusoriness, we can reject it on the grounds of uselessness. See, in other words, what can mankind do with his mysticism? Mysticism is something which, in some sense, has only helped mankind to become more unworldly. See, as he says, the mystic either detaches himself from life as the otherworldly ascetic or the aloof visionary, and therefore cannot help life, or else he brings no better solution or result than the practical man or the man of intellect and reason. By his intervention, he rather disturbs the human values, distorts them with his alien and unverifiable light, obscure to the human understanding, and confuses the plain, practical, and vital issues life puts before us. Now, as Sri Aurobindo will point out, there is some justification to this viewpoint. In the very second paragraph, chapter, of course, we have, he is bringing up this whole notion of the denial of the ascetic. The denial of the materialist and the refusal of the ascetic. The ascetic's refusal to engage with life. So that has caused a problem. The other problem is, of course, that without making an attempt to see what are the powers of the spirit, what transformative powers are possible, and what can be effected by power of spirit, there is already a rejection of it on the basis that it cannot be done. That's also partly because the history of spirituality has not given sufficient weight to the transformation of life. So one can say that these are the reasons that stand in the way. This is the partly the reason why Sri Aurobindo has come and gone. But the world at large has not embraced his solution, though it is the only true solution that one can find.
So, Devashishda, in essence, when you make that last statement, in essence, what you're saying is that as a group, it is not, it may not even be possible that people will find it as a group, correct? That the large mass will reject any solution which involves the spirit. It's only individually that such solutions can be attempted. Is that correct?
Yes, but I'd also take one step further and say that, you know, when we say as a group, of course, nothing is achievable as a group until that group becomes a critical mass of individuals. But I'd say there also, I'm not really saying that it is not possible in a general way. What I'm saying is that this is what stands in the way. Now, what can be done to mitigate it? I think what can be done to mitigate it is firstly to increase the criticism of the regime of mind, to point out, you know, in a penetrating manner to the thinkers of the world, to the political leaders of the world, to whatever, that there is going to be a dead end beyond which they can't move. So that becomes one of the, you know, duties of the modern intellectual. To some extent, it is being done, but it is still remaining, as it were, in very rarefied regions of thought. Okay, that is one thing. The other thing is that Sri Aurobindo has given a completely revolutionary description of the spiritual life. Not the kind of traditional description of the spiritual life which includes the refusal of the ascetic. He has gone beyond it to show that all life can be yoga, and that really revamps the whole ambit of human existence, social existence, creates a divine society in a sense. So both, I mean, from the viewpoint of you know, presenting this to people, presenting it not merely, I mean, the problem is that time has a way by which it constantly changes the mindset of people. Today's mindset is different from the mindset of the person who Sri Aurobindo was addressing, see? So, in a way, the language of today has to be, I mean, the consciousness that Sri Aurobindo is presenting of a transformed life has to be lived and engaged in the modern world. Whether it is engaged just through actions, activities, or through thoughts, through words, this inspiration of a world-transforming spiritual life has to become, in a sense, the message that we carry with us. Not the sort of evangelistic message, but the message of our lives, the exemplary message of our lives, as an example.
Vashisa, can you explain the last part, the evangelical word?
I said not as an evangelical message. In other words, evangelical, I mean not to preach about this, not to tell people, go around knocking them on the head and say, you know, the good news for modern man is that there is a solution that, you know, the avatar has given or something like that. But on the other hand, in the very living of a life in which a different power of expression finds voice, there is a subtle influence, and wherever there is an opening, to make sure that one does not hide, you know, what possibility of expression there is. So, you know, I've talked about this before, but I'm remembering it again, that, you know, there's a place where Sri Aurobindo was asked by Niruddha, you know, towards the end of his life, whether the supramental manifestation would occur in the ashram. And his answer, and this is actually in the letters itself, I mean, this is not something private or anything. His answer was, you don't expect a few hundred people in this ashram to manifest the supramental life. Thousands of people all over the world doing the yoga in the circumstances of their life will be needed for that. So this kind of an answer, this is what it's pointing to, that essentially, to just as Sri Aurobindo tested every step of the way in his own life, so too, the world yoga is also testing every step of its own way. And our lives are the way in which that is happening. So in a sense that, to the extent that we can engage the forces of the world in a total life sense and bring the power of the integral yoga into it, there will be the possibility of a wider and wider opening.
Jyoti, would you like to read the next paragraph? I can go. But this is not the standpoint from which the true significance of the spiritual evolution in man or the value of spirituality can be judged or assessed. For its real work is not to solve human problems on the past or present mental basis, but to create a new foundation of our being and our life and knowledge. The ascetic or otherworldly tendency of the mystic is an extreme affirmation of his refusal to accept the limitations imposed by material nature. For his very reason of being is to go beyond her. If he cannot transform her, he must leave her. At the same time, the spiritual man has not stood back altogether from the life of humanity, for the sense of unity with all beings, the stress of a universal love and compassion, the will to spend the energies for the good of all creatures are central to the dynamic outflowering of the spirit. I'll read the footnote there from the Gita. The Buddhist elevation of universe, for the good of all creatures, that was from the Gita. The explanation, the Buddhist elevation of universal compassion, karuna and sympathy, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, the whole earth is my family, to be the highest principle of action, the Christian emphasis on love, indicate this dynamic side of the spiritual being. He has turned therefore to help, he has guided as did the ancient rishis or the prophets, or stooped to create, and where he has done so with something of the direct power of the spirit, the results have been prodigious. But the solution of the problem which spirituality offers is not a solution by external means, though these also have to be used, but by an inner change, a transformation of the consciousness and nature.
So here Sri Aurobindo is pointing out that the argument made against the spiritual life having effect in the field of human existence or general human existence is usually undertaken with certain caveats. It's a conditional admittance into the club of humanity, as it were. That is, if you want to enter into our public life, then you must bring greater powers to solve the same things that we are trying to solve in the same way. See, more effective, you know, sort of negotiations, for example, or a kind of a more, you know, enlightened egoistic life, for example. So those are the type of solutions without transforming the being of mankind is what is sought. And so Sri Aurobindo is pointing out here that that is not really the domain or the way of the spiritual life. And here, you know, Sri Aurobindo takes a number of views. I mean, he looks at every problem from many sides. And in this particular instance, he's turning around and saying that if it is that in the past, man, the spiritual person has, you know, refused or denied, you know, the life, refused the life of man, it is because the life of man did not offer him any handle for transformation.
Mm-hmm.
It is to some extent because mankind was too far away. And he's made this point earlier as well, that the great spiritual figures of the past were forerunners. They were nature's avant-garde experiments. So, in a certain sense, they came before their time. And mankind at large was in no position to match up to the kind of transformative solutions that they could offer. So they had to carry on by themselves. They had to leave society behind to find their liberation. So as he says, liberation of the spirit and union with the divine are the foundations of the spiritual life. If that cannot be achieved, if that is conditioned to other kinds of demands and compromises, then the spiritual life has nothing to do with that. It will leave it aside. So the problems of mankind can be solved by the spiritual life only when mankind realizes that another foundation is necessary for the solution of those problems. A spiritual foundation is necessary. This is the point he's making. But then he's going on to say, it is not as if even those who left the life of general nature, samsara. See, this split takes place in India, again, from around the time of the Upanishads, between sannyasa and samsara. This split continues till this day. So that split, he's saying, is not something which has been entirely a kind of a watertight split, but that the great spiritual beings have effected their, you know, sort of their influence on the life of samsara, on the life of human beings. And it points to that ideal of Buddhism as well as of Christianity to some extent. Because, and then again we find that even with people like Vivekananda, with the notion of a Nara Narayana, that in a sense the spiritual man has to also keep his eye on the fact that the whole of humanity is the evolving body of God. See? So that is also part of the identity towards which we are invited. And yet, it is possible that there is another kind of foundation and another kind of integral life in which spirit has another part to play.
Lopa, can you hear me?
Yeah, a bit faint, but we can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to say my mic was causing trouble, but next time I can read it, you need me.
Sure, thanks.
I'm just going to mute it now.
But Debashista, this the influence of spirituality in life or to solve problems of life, they have been different in different cultures, right? It's a sweeping statement to say that it has not helped life at all.
Yeah, I mean, it has not helped life at all, meaning that, you see, again, it becomes a question of what are the ideals with which you lead life. If, you know, possession of material comforts and, you know, greater well-being in terms of self-advertisement becomes the ideal of life, naturally, spiritual life can do nothing about it. But, you know, if, on the other hand, you know, succor to the weak or justice for the right or a higher access to great things of beauty, there, of course, spirituality has, or even great inspired, you know, opening up new inspired ideals for mankind, there, of course, spiritual people have had contributions, and that's the point that he made earlier also, that the spiritual beings have left the greatest visions of the future of mankind, the highest visions of the future. So this is in fact, even in modern times, say for example in the field of psychology, you know, a kind of a revolution of some kind was achieved by someone by the name of Adler, okay, who basically said that to understand what is the human, empirical studies that find some kind of common denominator of humanity is not enough, because humanity lives by aspiration for the future of becoming something. So it is the great dreamers who have left, or the great achievers who have left ideals for mankind, that should form our understanding of the height of human achievement. Humanity should be defined by the height of his possibility, not by the commonness of his possibilities. So there, spiritual people come into the picture, because if somebody has claimed, and sufficient number, large number of people, not tremendously large, but sufficiently large number of people have claimed these numinous ideas, these cosmic ideas, to be realizable by mankind, naturally they form the highest pinnacle of human possibility. So, you know, these have been left behind by the spiritual people for mankind to open to, the day they're ready to open to it.
Debashita, in the Vedic yajñas, they say things like, we need more progeny, we need more cows. And so those things, do they have double meaning, or it is just the symbolic meaning that we should accept?
See, from a yogic point of view, it is the symbolic meaning, but they do have double meaning, because, you know, there is an interesting place in the ideal of human unity where Sri Aurobindo is talking about two kinds of progression that are going on simultaneously. So the Veda, from viewpoint of one kind of progression, is a primitive practice, because it is establishing rituals for primitive people. People who at that point, you know, are leading a kind of a tribe-clan life. You see, in the history of societies, it is a primitive stage. On the other hand, it represents a very high level of spirituality in a few. Those few have to then adapt their spiritual teaching to these primitive people and their social life. So what they do is they translate it into ritual. But at the same time, they also translate it into yoga. This is a really, that as we studied, you know, this study also, I started by talking about the agamas, which are divided into four parts. We can go back and see that even in the Veda, it is the same thing. Ritual and yoga, you know, I mean, later it becomes darshan and yoga. But in a more earlier time, and even in later times where darshan is going on, we say darshan, yoga, shastra, and puja. These are the four, you see, that characterize even modern Hinduism. So in the Veda itself, you have you know, this division into yoga and puja, or yoga and yajna, which happens. Yajna is meant for the more primitive kind of you know, social life, while yoga is the double speak of that in terms of inner experience.
Okay, so that's not an instance where spirituality has come to help aggrandize life.
Hello?
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe you have already said it, like right now. I just want to put it in my language. Are you trying to say something like, say, even in the form of rituals or something that has a surface reality which is doesn't immediately seem to be connected unless you put that symbolization to the yoga or, you know, the philosophy. But can it have like a trigger? Because everything is in a way reflection of the truth, right? Like even in the surface reality, many things, even very crude things also, like we see it as if we can find a deeper symbolic meaning of the same, we see that even that crude appearance is actually some kind of reflection of some reality, of some higher reality. So even through ritual, like it can point to that, but it has a possibility that even somebody is focusing on the surface thing, but inside we have so many layers of, psychological layers, there is an electric current that can flow from that surface meaning towards inward reality. I mean, I'm just trying to give it a thought.
No doubt. I mean, absolutely, because actually, see, that's the very reason why it has been converted into a ritual. It wasn't that it was converted into a ritual to pamper the desired life of the popular people, but it was converted into a ritual so that in a symbolic form, those who were open to it would receive something in their inner lives from it. But what happens is that these symbolic codes become lost over time and they devolve because there isn't the way to connect it to a higher truth. Unless, just as we were talking about, if yoga and darshan are kept very closely tied together, then this will not happen. Again, in a similar way, if yoga and yajna are kept very tightly together, then this will not happen. But what happens with the Veda is that with time, the priestly class, the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas, they start giving it a more, egoistic kind of interpretation, and it falls. So by the time of the Upanishads, already a split has taken place. And in the Upanishads, we find many utterances where they are basically saying that, they're trying to reclaim the yajna for the spiritual life. See, again, by the time of the Gita, it is saying, there is only as much truth in the working out of these rituals of the Veda as there is water in a well. See, there is very little in it. So that kind of degradation takes place over time. But certainly it was formed so as to give the inner sort of experience to the common man as well, through the symbol. It's also quite interesting, and we are talking about Veda, but it goes, I don't know whether Veda predates the Indus Valley or not. I don't want to get into that argument. But in Indus Valley also, we find quite interestingly the existence of both these forms. There are seals that will show you that there is yoga going on, and there are seals that will show you that very similar things are also being translated into ritual form, perhaps for common people or whatever. but the inner realities of yoga are being given objective forms through rituals.
I mean, it's pretty tricky, right? Like, for the mass, it's to find a solution. I mean, of course, Sri Aurobindo and Mother, they had a solution of one kind, but even that is also very difficult. I'm saying, like, even if you take out all the rituals and all these things which you apparently feel, I mean, if we see this kind of blind religiosity and all that, you feel like it's just all these things should be totally thrown away. But at the same time, if you see at the West, where it has been done to some extent at least, but then something else swallows it, like technology or capitalism or corporations or, like, you know, comfort altogether. Like, I'm talking about the general mass. It's very tricky to find a solution, what I'm saying. Like,
no, I agree, but what can be done about it? You see, that's the reason why I say the Upanishads tried to create a different kind of language, which ultimately became too esoteric in its own way. It became, you know, restricted to the initiates and only the people who can penetrate. General mass could not penetrate the Upanishads. Similarly, this is being seen today by maybe the teaching of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother also, in that, you know, only if it can be lived in life and some people open to it in different ways at different levels, then maybe it's a possibility. That's why the integral yoga offers a hope, I think, which is necessarily only intellectual, but can be opened into, can be experienced from many different points of entry and become integral from there. But it's also very important to, you know, make sure that none of these openings become exclusive, that they don't start demanding that any other kind of approach to the integral yoga must be shut down because this is the only way. So that is a difficulty, but at the same time, you know, perhaps, you know, the practice of the integral yoga in different forms by different kinds of people can open the possibility to much larger number of people.
Jyoti, would you like to read the next paragraph?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. And it's the paragraph beginning, if no decisive, right?
If no decisive, yes, that's correct.
If no decisive, but only a contributory result, and accretion of some new finer element to the sum of the consciousness has been the general consequence, and there has been no life transformation, which is because man in the mass has always deflected the spiritual impulsion recanted from the spiritual ideal, or held it only as a form and rejected the inward change. Spirituality cannot be called upon to deal with life by a non-spiritual method or attempt to cure its ills by the panaceas, the political, social, or other mechanical remedies which the mind is constantly attempting and which have always failed and will continue to fail to solve anything. The most drastic changes made by these means change nothing, for the old ills exist in a new form. The aspect of the outward environment is altered, but man remains what he was. He is still an ignorant mental being, misusing or not effectively ruled by ego and governed by vital desires and passions and the needs of the body, unspiritual and superficial in his outlook, ignorant of his own self and the forces that drive and lead him. His life constructions have a value as expressions of his individual and collective being in the stage to which they have reached, or as a machinery for the convenience and welfare of his vital and physical part, and the field and medium for his mental growth. But they cannot take him beyond his present self or serve as a machinery to transform him. His and their perfection can only come by his further evolution. Only a spiritual change, an evolution of his being from the superficial mental towards the deeper spiritual consciousness, can make a real and effective difference. To discover the spiritual man in himself is the main business of the spiritual man, and to help others towards the same evolution is his real service to the race. So that is done, an outward help can succor and alleviate, but nothing or very little more is possible.
So this is the radical message of Sri Aurobindo. He has brought it out over here again, and elsewhere also Sri Aurobindo has pointed out that no external change can offer the solutions for which man seeks. Such a change can only come through a change of human consciousness itself. Okay? So that's the bottom line, and he makes it very clear over here that, you know, we may struggle with the problem and we may pull out a number of solutions from our pockets and we may keep reworking the same solution again and again, but the fact is that we are never going to be able to solve any of our problems. It amounts to nothing. I mean, it's message is very radical. He's not saying we've gone a little bit ahead or whatever. This again relates to, you know, of course, again, everything that Sri Aurobindo says, he also says something else which conditions it. But, you know, there are a number of places where we've read ourselves earlier, where there are places where he says mankind has made no evolution. Or rather, the history of mankind or history of human civilization is not an evolution. Because whatever we have achieved is really just a continuation of the ego life. It's a greater refinement, maybe, of the ego life. We found subtler ways of achieving what we always achieved. That is, get the best that we can from whoever is around us for our own good and create a disharmony as a result. We have created more sophisticated compromises in the matter, but essentially there has been no evolution as such. If you take it an evolution to be something as a change of status, and even in his letters and conversations he has pointed out that only if we find that somebody has reached what he's calling here a spiritual consciousness, a change of consciousness, can we talk of an evolution of humanity. Before that, it is just another form of humanity. So here he's pointing out that there is all kinds of solutions we may try, but until we realize that it's not going to ultimately change anything, only change that can come is through the emergence of the spiritual being in us. Now, the thing is that problem with this argument is that people by and large are not convinced that there even exists such a thing as a spiritual existence that can solve the problems that humanity cannot solve otherwise. You see, the problem is one of scope. We make compromises if we feel that that's all that we can make. If we think that no, there can be a solution, then that compromise doesn't satisfy anymore. So the interesting part about this approach that Sri Aurobindo takes is this, that somewhere mankind has an intuition that our compromises are not enough. Again, the bottom line is that he is drawing on that intuition. He is calling upon mankind or humankind to wake up to his divine discontent. That is the thing that he started the first chapter with, that man is the greatest because he is the most discontent. That in a way, whatever solution we find, let's be honest about it. Are we content with it? We would have been content, just like the animal, in a sense, knows nothing about his future, its future, knows nothing about, you know, the impending death that waits for it lurking in the bush. So that when that comes upon him, it's only a temporary suffering. While mankind, by dint of the power of projection into the future, is marked by anxiety all his life because of the power of prediction. So similarly, that anxiety ultimately comes from a deeper source, which is the divine discontent. Because we know we can be divine. See, somewhere we know that whatever compromise and whatever failure or whatever success that we may achieve is not enough. And that's what he's drawing our attention to in this paragraph.
Debashishda, this came up in the previous chapter or so, right? Like the point you made about how Sri Aurobindo says humanity has really not evolved. It's only like, you know, some kind of a limited progress within a single range.
Within a circle, right.
Yes.
Actually, he says, within the circle of human existence and within an ascending curve of nature's evolution. So, it's as if human existence is going around in circles, exploring more and more of its own circular reality, while in nature, universal nature in the cosmic sense, mankind represents a certain kind of a level of ascent from the animal. And in that upward curve, it is stuck.
But that is true of humanity as a whole race, but not true of individuals.
Of humanity as a whole race. You see, that's the reason that these last six chapters, they are addressing the human race, actually. Though they are addressing the individual, they're addressing the individual as a representative of the human race. One thing you have to realize, it's a very important thing regarding Sri Aurobindo. Even as far as his bringing down of the supermind is concerned, there is a statement he makes. He says, there have been others before me who have known about the supermind and entered into relation or contact or even union with it, and have maintained the supermind in their existence by yoga siddhi. Then he says, I am not interested in maintaining the supermind by yoga siddhi. I am interested in bringing it down as a law of nature and transforming nature by its power. So ultimately what he is talking about is that individual solutions of yoga can always be there, but they will be considered to be freak solutions. He is concerned with the human change. The human change will not come about en masse. But it will come about only if we think of it as a human problem.
I mean, in Upanishad, that purifying the senses, that has been largely mentioned, right? So, you think that also didn't have any indication of this kind?
Indication of which kind?
Supermind.
Indication of bringing the supermind down. I mean, it may not have the name of the supermind, but something that can actually transform nature.
Yeah, if it is there, it is not made very explicit. You see, the one Upanishad that Sri Aurobindo kind of draws on to the greatest extent is the Isha Upanishad. In the Isha Upanishad, there is the notion of, you know, sort of a double yoga, yoga of the vidya and yoga of the avidya, of achieving the vidya to transform the avidya. But it is talked of in an individual way. It is not really talked of in a human race way, because it's too early at that point. At that point, the Upanishads were probably really written for the elect rather than for humanity as a race.
I mean, is it an? Are you saying that is most likely the case, or it is actually explicitly mentioned that it is not for the mass; it is for the selected individuals?
No, it is not specifically mentioned like that at all. In fact, you know, even as I was saying, you know, there are kind of very universalistic statements in the Upanishads, like that one about Shrinvantu Vishwe Amritasya Putra, that is, the whole of humanity is being addressed, you know, as the children of immortality. So perhaps there is a universalistic kind of, you know, scope to Upanishadic teachings, but somehow because of the height of the language, it remained extremely restricted to few.
I mean, language-wise, I don't know. I feel about Sri Aurobindo and the mother also is extremely elite.
That is true. I agree that it is elite. I think in a way it is very elite. I don't know how many people really open to the teaching of Sri Aurobindo and the mother in its depths. Something one may realize, you know, it's easy to realize the greatness of a being and admire that person, become a devotee, become a, you know, sort of somebody who lives by the ideal that person has created in the outer life. But to really delve into the depth of the message is perhaps very elite. But what I mean is that in these last six chapters, Sri Aurobindo, even in an elite way, is addressing the problems of humanity. That it's not so much, maybe if you say that the Upanishads were also doing the same, that to the elite of the land, they were actually addressing the problems of humanity. Maybe that's the case. But notion of humanity itself has reached a kind of universal sort of, you know, degree in modern times, which perhaps was not there to that extent at that time. Today we know that everybody who wears this kind of sense of, you know, being human, has the human anatomy, the human mind, is a human being. You know, that sense of the human as a universal reality has become much more strong today. At that time, people from clan to clan, they thought the next clan was something else, not really human. You see.
So you're saying we are more ready now?
I think we are much more ready now. I think we are more ready now. This message that Sri Aurobindo is giving, even when he's talking about mankind has gone round in a circle, he's saying it because he feels that we are at the point where we can recognize that. We can recognize the fact that it's time to break the circle.
I mean, just to share that this, even mother's writings, which seem, I mean, usually appears as a much simpler in language than compared to Sri Aurobindo. I mean, I have seen, I've given this kind of thing even to people who are supposed to be very sharp and intellectual otherwise. and very successful in the outside world and all that, but somehow they just don't get it, you know. Rather, if I say a few words from Upanishad about this sense and Purusha behind the senses, maybe that will be more understandable to them. But if they read even the mother, not even Sri Aurobindo, it's like, okay, what to make out of it? You know, it's like, I don't understand, because I cannot place myself in their shoes, but I don't even I just become surprised, that's all. But it has consistently happened.
Yeah, yes, it's very possible. Yeah, but I think, you know, what is happening, it's actually a very interesting point, what you're making. In fact, mother's statements, I mean, both of them are paradoxical in a way. Mother's statements, while being very simple, are actually much more intimate to the truth. And Sri Aurobindo's, while seeming much more difficult, are actually much more general and, you know, sort of appealing to the whole of humanity. Mother's already is sort of, you know, addressed to somebody who has opening and has opened to some extent. You know, these kind of chapters, for example, I don't know how many people would be open to it, but he's making an appeal, I think, to the whole of humanity. That's the thing, one of the things I find so attractive about Sri Aurobindo is the power of his appeal to the whole of humanity.
I mean, could it also be like there is a cosmic psychology that has developed over the years with the usual, I mean, the pattern or certain studies that has been going on for many, many decades, whereas mother's language is something which people are not used to. Is it possible?
No, that I completely agree, because you see that when you say about things like Upanishads and all being more understandable, I don't think they're really understandable, but what you are saying is exactly what I think happens, that people feel more comforted by the fact that, okay, somebody is mentioning the Upanishads, which have a traditional weight, while this one is completely alien to me. And the mother uses a language which cuts through. She doesn't depend on any traditions. It's straight language of consciousness. So that doesn't give them a handle of, you know, that traditional thing by which they can, you know, feel supported even without understanding what it is that is being said.
So, Bhashita, the crux of this issue of the individual versus society and humanity is this little sentence where Sri Aurobindo is saying, the aim of the individual will be, I'm not reading it, will be to help others to awaken to the spiritual need.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, actually, it's the last sentence. To discover the spiritual being in himself is the main business of the spiritual man, and to help others towards the same evolution is his real service to the race.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's the bridging sentence between the spiritualities of the past and Sri Aurobindo's spirituality.
Yeah, to somebody, you see the other part of, when you say bridging, you see the other part is that, you know, this, it's appeal to the individual, but its appeal is to the universal individual. That's the point I was making. Even if you look at it from the viewpoint of language, it's written in the English language. How many people can get it in their hands and read it? How many people understand it is another matter, but the accessibility is tremendous, you know. And so there is a higher power which is at work. The possibility is always there that anybody who can read the English language, and this book falls into their hands, and the inner opening is suddenly there, they will be able to open to it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the Veda, we have been studying like this kind of like soma extra. I mean, they're giving, sacrificing the soma to the maruts so that they can roll the chariots and all that stuff. That is, you're actually addressing the those selected individuals who can actually, who are ready to do that sacrifice. And I mean, like givers, doers, this kind of addressing, of course, it is again in Sri Aurobindo's language in interpretation of Rig Veda. But that has been like almost in every hymn, it is addressing like that. However, I think still, I mean, there is a difference. I mean, what I have seen so far is that in Sri Aurobindo's,
sorry, no, we just lost you the last minute or the last few words. Could you repeat it, Keka? I think she got disconnected. I'm trying to add her again. There was that we can try to add her once more and.
Okay. Otherwise, we can stop for today.
Yeah, it's getting close to 9:30. We'll give it one more try for a few more seconds and. Oh, actually, she's gone offline now. So.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
So okay, then we can resume next time.
Sure, Devashishda. Let's stop with a brief meditation.